Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing activism, nonprofits, and social justice. I'm your host, Ethan Clow, and we're broadcasting here at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Now you might be asking yourself, boy, this host, this Ethan Clow, he sounds familiar. Where have I heard his voice before? Well, if you've listened to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast promoting science and skepticism and critical thinking, you'll know that I actually hosted Radio Freethinker for several years. Right now, the show is being hosted by my good friend Don, and it airs Tuesdays at 3 o'clock, so you should tune in and listen to Radio Freethinker. And in fact, I may stop by from time to time to help out Don with the hosting duties of that show. In the meantime, though, you're probably asking, well, what is this sector all about? And why is Ethan here talking to us about it? The Sector, this show you're listening to right now, will dive into various issues related to nonprofits, social justice, and activism, discussing trends, activities, and the future. On our first episode of The Sector, we'll be discussing fundraising and talking about its relationship with sales. We'll also be discussing social justice, exactly what is social justice, and we'll get into that as well. Later on, we're going to have an interview with Michael Payton, who is a nonprofit activist with several years of experience leading organizations as well as developing policy and fundraising. We'll pick his brain a bit later on. But why would you listen to me? After all, I'm just your regular old host. Am I an expert? I wanted to give you a bit of a background on who I am and why I'm doing this show, and perhaps what we can learn together. I've been working in the nonprofit sector for about 3 years. I've been a volunteer with several organizations and causes, and I'm currently taking courses at BCIT in their nonprofit management program. Now, all this to say that I don't consider myself an expert, quote. I know a thing or two about the nonprofit sector, but this show is as much my education as it can be yours, and I hope that together we can learn a whole lot. So, what do we mean when we talk about the nonprofit sector? So here in Canada, we have three primary sectors: the business or private sector, government, and the not-for-profit sector. Our nonprofit sector is the second largest in the world and worth about 8% of our GDP. There are over 160,000 nonprofits in Canada, and about 80,000 of those are registered charities. The Canadian Revenue Agency dryly informs us that a nonprofit is a club, society, or association that's organized and operated solely for social welfare, civic improvement, pleasure or recreation, or any other purpose except profit. Now, if a nonprofit wants to become a charity, it must adhere to the Canadian Revenue Agency's strict definition of what it means to be a charity, namely, quote, the relief of poverty, the advancement of education, the advancement of religion, or certain other purposes that benefit the community in a way that the courts have said is charitable. Of course, one might wonder a bit about those qualifications and who decided that those were the only forms a charity could take. And no doubt we'll come back to this for future shows. For the purposes of this discussion, this is the groundwork for all nonprofits and charities in Canada. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector, and we'll be back with more after this.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy, in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, and welcome back to The Sector here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Again, I am your host, Ethan Clow, and we're talking about charities in Canada. Now, we just summarized what it means to be a charity in Canada. The question is, if a nonprofit is supposed to be nonprofit, how does it get money? Well, the answer to that question is fundraising. And fundraising has been something of a dirty word in the past. We think of fundraisers as those people who call in the middle of overtime during Game 7 of the Stanley Cup playoffs, or the people knocking on our door during dinner, or the people sending you emails, and you're not even sure how they got your email, requesting a contribution to some cause. Some would even go so far as to say that fundraising is really only one step away from sales. Not the good kind of sales either. We're talking about really seedy sales like used car sales. Now, is the comparison between fundraising and sales a fair example? Let's talk about that a little bit here on The Sector. There are a number of similarities between fundraising and sales. Typically, the more optimistic and perhaps idealist of us view fundraising and sales as completely different. With sales, you're getting something out of it. There is a product or service, and the salesperson is getting a commission. However, the more cynical, if I may use that word, might say that, well, if you give a donation, you're getting a tax receipt, or bragging rights, or guilt relief, or whatever, and the fundraiser is getting paid. So there is an exchange of goods and services in some form or another. Now, we also have to assume in this case that the fundraiser is a professional fundraiser and not a volunteer. But if we look more at the similarities, a fundraiser is trying to influence an individual or organization to, quote, believe in something, to place a value on it, typically a mission or a cause. Now, again, so does Apple or Microsoft when they encourage you to buy an iPad or Windows. They're asking you to make a belief value decision that this is a good product. And furthermore, that this product fits your personality, that it's a good thing for you to have. If you walk into the Apple store, one of their salespeople is going to try to sell you a product. Now, you may want that product, but are you a motivated buyer? After all, most of us want to end poverty, but it doesn't mean that we're going to go write a check right now for a nonprofit. So, like a salesperson, a fundraiser has to make you want to give. Likewise, when you walk into that Apple store and you are thinking to yourself, boy, I would really like to buy that iPhone 7 or 8 or whatever we're up to at this point, you may not buy it right then and there. Now, that salesperson is going to try their hardest to make sure that you do. And likewise, the fundraiser, they're going to say, well, I assume this person wants to help change the world. What do I have to say? What do I have to do to encourage them to make that contribution now instead of later? When we think of sales and that person who is trying to sell you that iPad 2, 3, 4, 5, or whatever, we don't necessarily have the most positive opinion about them. They're trying to sell you on the most expensive thing they can. But are fundraisers different? Won't they try to convince you to give $100 instead of $50? Now, there's really no right answer to this question, and I've heard it said that fundraisers sell hope, which is about as close as you can really get on this one, in my opinion. What's interesting to think about is some of the ways that sales and fundraising are different. So, unlike in sales, fundraisers do not get commission. In fact, while there are no official rules or laws about that, there are a lot of unofficial rules that many fundraisers and fundraising associations and foundations subscribe to, forbidding fundraisers to gain a commission for a donation. Most claim that it's completely unethical for fundraisers to take commission. Now, this is an interesting point, and we're going to come back to this in future episodes about ethics with fundraising, But again, I think we should revisit the sales and fundraising question, because this is a very important issue going forward for the nonprofit community. As our population ages and as demographics change, we're going to find it increasingly difficult to find donations, especially during times of financial struggles. So adapting principles and tactics used by sales may be an answer. How do we feel about that? How do you feel about that? The idea that fundraisers may be using tactics found in the Apple Store. Is fundraising such a normal profession that we're willing to look past that? If somebody who is convinced to give a donation of, say, $2 million to help relieve poverty, does it matter how the fundraiser convinced that person to donate? These are difficult questions, and there's no, again, right answer to these questions. It's going to require a lot of careful thought and analysis. And I hope that you will find that analysis and that careful thought here on The Sector. Why don't we take a quick break, and we'll be back with more after this.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or check us out online at citr.ca.
We just played Velvet Dinosaurs and their latest hit, Eating the Plate. Now, let's go to the phones and hear what you have to say. Go ahead, caller, you're on the line.
Smash the dirty red scum!
Really?
Kill!
That's really
kill! Wrong. Kill! Filthy bastard Tommy! I hate him!
Okay, well,
You know, maybe you should relax a little bit. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on The Sector. So, as we mentioned at the top of the show, social justice is an important part of what we're going to be talking about here on The Sector. And many of the causes and issues that nonprofits focus on are related to the field of social justice. So, what is social justice? A United Nations 2006 document titled Social Justice in an Open World, The Role of the United Nations, had this to say on the subject, quote, "The notion of social justice is relatively new. None of history's great philosophers, not Plato or Aristotle, or Confucius or Averroes, or even Rousseau or Kant, see the need to consider justice or the redress of injustices from a social perspective. The concept first surfaced in Western thought and political language in the wake of the Industrial Revolution and the parallel development of the socialist doctrine. It emerged as an expression of protest against what was perceived as the capital's exploitation of labor and as a focal point for the development of measures to improve the human condition. It was born as a revolutionary slogan embodying the ideals of progress and fraternity. Following the revolutions that shook Europe in the mid-1800s, social justice became a rallying cry for progressive thinkers and political activists. By the mid-20th century, the concept of social justice had become central to the ideologies and programs of virtually all the leftist and centralist political parties around the world." End quote. So, an in-depth analysis of what social justice is. But how can we understand it in perhaps a less dense way? And that's a difficult question because it's going to be different for each person. For some people, social justice is a field of scholarly academic research, or additionally, a source of causes, issues, things both political and socioeconomic. Social justice is a left-leaning philosophy, if we can even call it a philosophy. It's an acknowledgement that society, beyond the individual, beyond our personal control, can influence our lives. Of course, that's a bit succinct. I think that it goes deeper than that. When we look at progressive politics, we see a willingness to acknowledge the role of society impacting the individual. This is where we get concepts like liberalism. Whereas with a conservative viewpoint, we tend to look at the individual. We look at personal responsibility. We look at all things being equal. What can the individual accomplish? But social justice takes a different approach. It takes an entirely different attitude. It's not about what the individual can or should accomplish. It's what the individual can do, depending on what society throws at you. Now, that's sort of one view, and perhaps influenced by my own personal views. But again, as I said, it's going to be different for each person. Everyone's going to have their own way of looking at things. And this show, more than anything else, I want it to be a way for us to air these views and to think about them, to discuss them. But I don't want the sector to be about knocking people down or taking apart someone's views and skewering them. Unless, of course, they're objectively skewerable, horrible ideas. That's a throwback to Radio Freethinker days. But the point being is, if we're going to discuss these topics, we have to be willing to be wrong. We have to acknowledge the fact that sometimes we're just not informed. And that's a really important step. I think a huge first step in understanding and talking about social justice. First, acknowledge the fact that it's likely you're going to be wrong, and that's okay. So what do you think of that quotation? Do you think that that accurately sums up what social justice is and its role in society? Obviously, that's a bit political. There are references there to leftist political movements, including socialist revolution. But in today's society, we certainly have a different view of social justice. We don't, at least here in Canada, call somebody a socialist for donating to charity. And yet, nonprofits rely on social justice as a field, as an institution, as a source of academic insight to do their mission and cause. So I'm curious what our listeners think about this. Where do you see the boundaries of social justice? Where do you see the need in society for intervention, for change, and for progression? We don't need to look further than Vancouver to get an idea of how the changing view of social justice has impacted our lives and how the nonprofit community has adapted to these changes. For example, InSight, the only safe injection site in Canada, has been a frequent case in the social justice arena. The central debate is over the use of, quote, harm reduction as a drug policy. Compared to the old method that became popular in the 70s and 80s, the war on drugs. What is the responsibility of the community when it comes to dealing with drug use and addiction? What about the responsibility of the addicts and the users themselves? Unfortunately, I don't have an answer to these questions. I don't think anyone really does. But hopefully here on the sector, we can explore these questions and perhaps come up with some possible answers. And I'm interested to hear what you, the listener, have to think as well. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with our interview with Michael Payton.
Making a cuppa?
Stop! How many cups of tea are you making? What? There's enough for 10 cups in there. Only boil the amount of water that you actually need. Very good, old boy.
That's right. The British are making less tea to conserve energy. Students can conserve energy too.
A student's life often follows a pattern: eat, sleep, study. During this routine, don't forget to make time for energy conservation. This will be the easiest thing you do all semester, and a little bit goes a long way. Do your laundry in cold water and hang clothes on standing dry racks or clotheslines instead of using electricity-intensive dryers. If a dryer is the only option, Throw in a dry towel with wet clothes to absorb moisture and cut down on drying time.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9.
Joining us now is Michael Payton. Michael has been working in the nonprofit industry for several years. In addition to policymaking and volunteering, he was the National Executive Director of the Center for Inquiry Canada. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Good to be here.
So what do you see as the big difference between working in the nonprofit industry versus the for-profit sector?
Well, that's quite a big question. There's a lot of differences, and not all of them are completely obvious to people who get involved in the nonprofit sector. I see often that there are people that come into the nonprofit sector, and they usually get their training in some way from working in high-level management or as an entrepreneur in the for-profit sector. And there's a lot of differences. Some of them are very obvious, and some of them are not so obvious. So I think the obvious differences would be there's a lot more attention paid to administration in a nonprofit. There's a lot more things that you have to do, such as going through an audit every year. That's very rare for a for-profit industry. Fundraising is a very different sort of skill than just pure sales is. But I think some of the more subtle differences are often the most important ones. For instance, I think in the nonprofit industry that a huge emphasis has to be put on trust in the organization. Board members have to trust their employees, the employees have to trust their board members, the volunteers have to entrust to the directors, to their staff, the donors have to trust that their money is being put into a worthwhile cause and is being used effectively. Of course, there's obviously ways that you can evidentially prove that things are being done effectively. But I think the really successful charities are the ones that really instill in their entire organization a sense of trust. And that is sometimes very different than the for-profit industry, because trust isn't something that just kind of comes out of the ground. It's something that you actually have to actively be enculturating in your organization. And it's something that's it's a unique skill set to have someone or a group of people that can really instill that type of trust in the donors and the volunteers and in the staff.
There almost seems to be a different standard when it comes to nonprofits for trust, and that we almost kind of expect the for-profit industry to be a bit unscrupulous. But with nonprofits, we tend to expect a very high degree of trust and a very intensive amount of due diligence on who we donate to and what the money is being spent on.
Yeah, there's a lot of literature on this as well. And in many ways, this mirrors a lot of the problems that happen in the public sector as well. We have a similar sort of attitude towards public sector employees, as you just mentioned. Everyone wants to donate for the cause. For the same reason, everyone wants their tax dollars to go into palpable, like concrete changes that happen in society. They want their roads plowed. They want their subways built. Like, I'm in Toronto, that's a common complaint with us, is we want our subways built. We want our money to be used effectively. In the for-profit industry, there isn't nearly as much oversight that happens over the organization. There's not really even the expectation that money is being used in that hyper-effective manner. For instance, working in the for-profit industry, it won't be uncommon to have a high-level client. You might take them out to dinner, you might take them out to drinks, and you know, that's sort of expected as just like the cost of doing business. In the nonprofit industry and in the public sector, we see those things as being, you know, inappropriate. We see those things as being a poor use of funds, because we expect everything to go directly into managing the cause. And I think that is a really big difference between the for-profit and the not-for-profit industry, is that you don't just have to be effective in the nonprofit industry, but you have to be ruthlessly effective. And that's often a very, very difficult sort of bar to achieve. And it creates a lot of sort of internal problems, and the internal problems especially relating to trust, because there can be differences of opinion about what is the most effective use of funds. And the most effective use of time as well can change from time to time and depending on a variety of external circumstances. So I think people who work in the nonprofit industry tend to be, and the public sector, tend to be much more cautious and a lot more sensitive to the problems around being effective and letting the public or letting your donors know that you're being effective.
Well, we already just touched on the issue of overhead, but I wanted to ask you about that. There's a concern that large amounts of money get spent on staff, administration, and organization versus the cause and capitals. What's your take on this?
Well, I think oftentimes it's a bit misleading. In even high-level charities that have, in Canada at least, they even have certain metrics that they have to use. So they're only allowed to allowed legally to spend a certain amount of money on administration versus actually carrying out the mandate of the organization. And I think this is one of those sort of policy decisions or one of these laws that are good in theory, but oftentimes the way they're actually played out aren't always to the benefit of the cause. In large corporations and large charities especially, there are even laws or policies that are mandated by the Canadian government that require them to only spend a certain amount of money on administration versus carrying out the mandate of the organization. But the way that they're actually carried out in the organization may in fact in some cases be detrimental to the cause. For instance, in high-level organizations that I've had the pleasure of working for now, the way they get around those administrative hurdles or those sort of metrics that they have to use are that they use staff in in different capacities. So they'll have each staff member who is devoted to a particular area of the organization, someone who would, in a for-profit industry, for example, just be tasked with administrative work, will also have to divide some of their time into doing something that can be related to the mandate of the organization. And I think that that's, in some cases, that can actually be very bad for the organization. There's a certain amount of efficiency and effectiveness that comes from having someone just devoted to one particular task instead of scattered around into a bunch of different areas of the organization. There's also a lot of ways that organizations meet these metrics just by way of dividing hours or cutting hours in some cases, simply because if they went farther over that limit, they'd be changing their metrics. And in many cases, that leads to a number of greater administrative costs because now they have to go to the trouble of budgeting and calculating these costs in terms of hours paid and salaries, in terms of material resources. And there is a cost of just doing those calculations, and there's a cost of monitoring it basically all of the time, so that it really starts to slow things down for the organization. Now, this isn't to say that I think those sort of metrics need to be removed, but I think we have to be a bit more permissive that what we're looking at is not effectiveness in terms of just having low administrative costs and the money being used in the direction that we think it should go. But we should be looking at charities in terms of effectiveness. And there is a difference between those two ideas. Effectiveness is just with the same budget, with the same use of resources, are they able to have the impact in the world that they're supposed to? And the fact that we concentrate more on efficiency and the way things are run rather than the actual effect it has on the world, I think is at least debatable. And has been, this problem has been brought up by a lot of different people in the nonprofit industry. And to my thinking, I think there is a point to saying that we're much more interested in, for instance, a charity that is able from year to year to increase the number of like literate children that they're able to help through their programming, or the number of lives they're able to save, or the number of animals they're able to save, like whatever the cause might be. Like if there's some sort of metric that they're able to be more effective, even if they have to shuffle around their administrative costs internally, like I'm less concerned about those administrative costs. I'm less concerned about how they manage things internally. I'm more concerned about the impact that they actually have external to the organization.
And speaking of nonprofits in Canada, what do you think are the biggest challenges that they face?
Well, there's a number of challenges that Canadian nonprofits do face that are different than the challenges that they face in the United States. I certainly think the Canadian culture tends to be a little bit different in terms of fundraising. Canadians tend to be a bit, shall we say, reluctant to ask for money, as where I think a lot of the charities in Europe and the United States, it's just known as a matter of course that fundraising is done. I do a lot of consulting now, and the problem I've seen with basically every organization I've run into is that they have trouble with their budget, they have trouble fundraising, but they also have the deeper problem of every single person in the organization is reluctant to ask for money. And I think that that's a cultural piece of the Canadian landscape that really is a challenge for people that work in the nonprofit industry, because there's really nothing that you can do without fundraising properly and without networking properly. And these are things that Canadians, for whatever reason, seem to be fairly uncomfortable with.
And speaking of the fundraising, what do you consider are the best practices?
I think fundraising, if I can go back to an earlier comment I made about a charity or a nonprofit organization being essentially run with trust. The best practices in fundraising are usually done through proper relationship building. And that always seems to be the missing link in organizations that, again, have problems with fundraising. There's some part of what they're doing that is absent the relationship building process. It's important to remember too, when people give, when I become a donor, when I decide to give money to an organization, I'm trusting that it's being used properly. And importantly too, I have to have some sort of ongoing relationship with the organization in order to feel like that sense of trust is well met. And that if I feel that sense of trust and that relationship is maintained with me, and I feel a certain pride in my donation, then I'm more likely to continue giving and give in larger amounts. So if I were to ask what is like the central best practice, it is really to maintain the relationship with your donors and maintain and think of creative ways to maintain a strong relationship with the people who fund the organization. Anytime I've seen organizations who are struggling with fundraising, that has been the missing link. That has been the key that they've yet to figure out to raise funds effectively. And one of the most important things I tell people as well is that it's often not just about fundraising, and it's more about, and what the language I give them is to say, you're asking for help, because help can come in many different varieties. You're calling your donors, you're talking to your donors, and even someone who doesn't have the disposable income to make a large donation to you, they may have networks of people that can help you. They may have skills that they can volunteer. They can have advice that they give. There's a lot of different ways that donors can help an organization. And if the relationship's there, then they're willing to use those skills or those networks or those funds to help. And that, again, is another big conceptual thing. It's one of those pieces that are different from a nonprofit and a for-profit industry. In a for-profit industry, you're interested in making the sale. In the nonprofit industry, you're interested in building the relationship and having your people help you in any way you can.
And there's been an ongoing debate within fundraising within nonprofits about the role of social media and what part it can play in that process. Where do you see it fitting in?
Well, I think the jury is really out on the effectiveness of social media to do any kind of sale. The Harvard Business Review noted in the beginning of 2013, I'm not sure where the literature is now, but that they noted that a lot of organizations, nonprofits included, had invested a lot of time and money into Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Pinterest, all of these social media avenues, without ever really seeing what the metric is to how those relate to any sort of sales. And I think for nonprofit industries, like any industry, really, they should be asking more questions and doing more analysis to see, is the social media piece really working in favor of the organization? Is it helping the organization recruit volunteers, recruit donors, spread the message of the organization? I think it depends certainly on what the goals are, but I think we're nowhere close to really understanding what the relationship is between these new social media technologies and how that translates into donors and volunteers and expansion of the cause. So I'm at the moment actually quite skeptical of how important it is. And I think in many cases, I think it has a lot more to do with the goals of the organization and what they intend to do with their social media platform.
And related to social media, there's this term slacktivism, which is getting tossed around a lot these days. In your opinion, what is slacktivism and what can we do about it?
Well, I think slacktivism is usually related to a few different phenomena. And I think it's kind of a misunderstood idea as well. Most people take slacktivism as being the type of armchair activism that takes place when you like or comment on a story about a charity or about a cause without doing anything more than that. That's also tends to be like this isn't any sort of, it's not like there's some sort of written in stone definition, but it also seems to be somehow related to the millennial generation, people roughly my age, who seem to like and share and comment on stories in social media, but then they don't donate at the same levels as other generations. So I think really to understand slacktivism and what we can do about it, we have to carve up that problem in a bunch of different ways. For starters, looking at the millennial generation, the millennial generation, people who are now 35 and below, they've never been worse off financially. They're a demographic that has had awful times with receiving and retaining employment. They don't have a lot of disposable income, even when you compare that age group to previous generations. And I think they're, I am a millennial myself, so I feel that a lot of literature on the millennials tends to be very misunderstood. It tends not to take that into account. It's not that I think millennials don't want to donate. It's that they really just don't have the resources to do it. Often they're shouldered with significant student debt, also larger than any generation before. Their housing cost is much higher than it has ever been before. Like the millennial generation has significant hurdles that I think other generations before have not faced. And so it makes it difficult for them to find the income to actually support the causes that they care about. In terms also of just looking at the number of people who like or comment on a story or share a story versus those that actually donate, we also have to remember that the percentage of a population that actually regularly donates to charity is tiny, and I'd say probably roughly 4.5%. And we have to remember that when we're thinking of the number of people that actually may agree with the cause versus the number of people that will donate and support that cause. So I heard, for instance, I was consulting with a group. They had a very excellent social media campaign. They also have very good demographics of people who agree with their cause. So they had said to me in our consulting session that there are 40 million people in Canada, approximately, and about 20% of the population agree with their cause, like have listed in a survey that they actively agree with this cause. And so their rationale then turned into, well, if that is true, then we should have roughly 8 million members, and we have closer to 2,000. And I pointed out to them that, you know, so there's a big difference between someone liking a status or filling out a survey saying, I agree with this cause, and them actually putting money towards it or getting active in it. And I would say, like, they were much closer to maybe having something closer to 8,000 or 10,000 members as a goal than they were to, you know, 8 million people. That's just part of human nature. And I think, well, like, when we're doing that analysis of social media trends, or when we're doing that analysis of what's sometimes called market analysis in the for-profit industry, we have to remember that in generations before and decades before and now too, it's still a very small part of the population that regularly gives to charity. That is why so much time is spent, and why I always tell the clients I'm consulting with that the people who have already donated to you and have already shown an interest in your cause are the low-hanging fruit that you want to spend the most time on, because it's such a small part of the population that will even go that far, that maintaining that relationship, building that relationship, is a far more effective use of resources than basically anything else you can do.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael, for joining us on the show, and hopefully we'll talk again in the future.
Yes, I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Anybody's help in any way. Now, but now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Welcome back to The Sector with me, your host, Ethan Clow, here on CITR 101.9 FM. Our thanks to Michael Payton for the interview. Very insightful, and I'm looking forward to chatting with him again in the future. We are getting near the end of the show, and I hope you have enjoyed our first episode. And if you haven't, well, keep in mind, it was our first episode. Before signing off, though, I'd like to tell you a bit about what you can expect on The Sector. Next episode, we will have an interview with Siobhan Aspinall, who is a professional fundraiser and instructor at BCIT in their nonprofit management program. Additionally, you can expect more interviews from nonprofit activists and social justice proponents and other insightful people. We will soon be launching our online presence, including our webpage and Twitter, so be sure to keep your eye out for those. In the meantime, you can check out citr.ca to download the podcast of today's episode and take it with you on the go. Before we end off today's show, it's time for our recurring segment, Pitch of the Week. This segment is where we ask one of our guests here on the show for their pitch. That is an elevator pitch, a 30-second to 1-minute pitch that they would make to somebody to encourage them to donate to a charity of their choice. It could be their own charity, or it could be charity in general. And for the sake of good fun, we can say that the person they're pitching to could be a multi-billionaire, maybe Bill Gates or some other very rich person. Now, since I'm the only one here, we'll get my pitch of the week. So keep in mind that as the host of the show, I can take a bit longer to do my pitch because, let's face it, I'm the host and it's my show. So, Ethan's pitch of the week. When it comes to fundraising, one of the trends that I've noticed is that donors want to know where their money is going. Now, typically, the concern is that it's going to be swallowed up by something called overhead. Now, the concept of overhead is controversial, to say the least, and we'll come back to this repeatedly on The Sector. But for the sake of argument, I think it's important to inform donors of what their money is going to. And you should have an idea ahead of time what you're going to be asking and what that donor wants to give to. So for instance, if you have a donor who has shown no interest whatsoever in animals, don't ask them for a donation to the SPCA. The trick is to understand that a donor probably wants to help. Very few people in life don't want to help. So you have to figure out what it is that they want to have their name attached to, because they have to feel ownership of whatever it is they're giving to. Now, what you're probably saying is that, Ethan, this doesn't sound like a pitch. It sounds like a pitch advice. And yes, it is. But again, my show, so I guess I changed the rules a little bit. Basically, the key factor here is not so much what you're pitching for, it's how you pitch it. So whatever it is you want someone to give money to, you really have to get across to that person that you think this particular cause is a fit for them. It's actually, in my opinion, usually about fitting the cause to the donor and not the donor to the cause. That may not sound like it makes sense right now, but if you think about it, if you were approached by somebody and they were going to ask you to make a huge donation, and assume you have the capacity to make that donation, you want to make sure that whatever it is you're going to write a check for, whether it's $10,000 or $50 million, you want to make sure that it's something that you believe in, something that you care about, and something that you can feel a connection to. You don't want somebody to come up to you and try to finagle a cause to make it sound right. You don't want to be tricked. You don't want to be duped. You want to hear an honest explanation of where the money is going, what it does, who it serves. You don't want to be sold something just because you have a big checkbook. And even if you don't have a big checkbook, even if you're only being asked for $10 or $20, it's the same principle. You don't want to be sold something that you don't care about. Recently, CITR had its own fund drive, a very successful one that I might add, and I'm very proud and honored to be part of it. And one of the reasons why it was a success is because we weren't selling people something that didn't exist. We weren't telling you, please donate right now so that CITR can build a zoo. Nobody would donate to a zoo for CITR, although it would be kind of cool. Anyway, the point being, though, is that we were honest. We said, look, this is what the money is for. We're moving into a new studio. We need help. We're a radio station. We don't have corporate sponsorship, so we need help. These are all true facts. And the people who respond to that are people who care about these issues. We didn't try to trick them or dupe them into thinking that this is something they support. That's really important, and that's why this rambling speech is my pitch of the week. Well, we have reached the end of the first episode of The Sector, and once again, listeners, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening to me talk about fundraising and social justice, and I hope you'll tune in next week for more in-depth discussion of the nonprofit world. And again, this show is meant to be a learning experience for both of us. So let me know what you think. Send us your suggestions, your comments, even your criticisms, because we can take it. We want to know what you're interested in, and we want to dive into the nonprofit world and understand it. So what do you not know about the nonprofit world that you want to learn about? What do you want to see us investigate, and who do you want to have on the show? We're going to be interviewing various activists over the course of our run, so let us know. Which nonprofit have you always been interested in? What would you like us to ask when we have an executive director or a fundraising coordinator or somebody here with us? What sort of question should we be putting to them to help you understand the nonprofit world a bit more? Well, you think about that and get back to us. Until next week, this is Ethan Clow, your host of The Sector. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is Tony Bardock of the Little Guitar Arming, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.